Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's panel discussion. This is the third evening of the Bauhaus Lectures, organized by the Center for Critical Studies in Architecture. Let me quickly introduce myself in German. Mein Name ist Maxi Schreiber. Ich bin Mitglied beim Center for Critical Studies in Architecture und wissenschaftliche Mitarbeiterin am Fachgebiet Architektur und Kunstgeschichte an der TU Darmstadt. Ich möchte darauf hinweisen, dass die Veranstaltung heute in englischer Sprache ist, aber Sie sind natürlich eingeladen, Fragen dann auch auf Deutsch zu stellen und wir werden das übersetzen. I'll continue in English now, and I'd like to give you a brief overview of our agenda this evening. So tonight we're going to hear two 15 to 20 minute talks from Thorsten Lange and Michael Osman. Following that, a panel discussion with time for questions from the audience. Our theme today is appropriating modernism from the office to the state. And we are going to discuss the role that specifications and standardization play in architectural modernism. To that end, Thorsten Lange will, very generally speaking, talking about the reception of the Bauhaus in the GDR, and Michael Osman will discuss the role of specifications in 19th century American architecture. Let me now introduce our guests. Thorsten Lange is an architectural historian and architect. He's a visiting lecturer for the theory of architecture at the Institut GTA at ETH Zürich. He received his PhD from the Bartlett School of Architecture at University College London in 2015. The title of his dissertation is Komplexe Umweltgestaltung, Complex Environmental Design, Architectural Theory and the Production of the Built Environment in the German Democratic Republic, 1960 to 1990. His fields of research include 20th century architecture and urbanism in socialist Eastern Europe. Very recently, he co-edited the three-volume publication East-West Central, Rebuilding Europe, 1950 to 1990. Michael Osman is an architectural historian and architect. He's associate professor of architecture and urban design at University of California in Los Angeles. His research focuses on American modern architecture. He seeks connections between the infrastructure that undergirds the process of modernization and the historiography of modernist architecture. In his 2018 book, Modernism's Visible Hand, Architecture and Regulation in America, he highlights the history of environmental and economic systems of regulation in the United States. He's a founding member and current chair of Aggregate, the Architectural History Collaborative. It's my pleasure to have you two here, and let's start with our first talk from Thorsten.
Thank you for the kind introduction, and thanks for the invitation, Maxi, as the organizer of the evening, but also to Christiane Salge and to Carsten Ruhl. I'm going to start right away. Fall 1984, East Germany, Leipzig Trade Fair. A couple of peculiar objects, more precisely, two design portfolios that document speculative urban design and housing schemes for the cities of Dessau and Erfurt are displayed at the Finnish exhibition booth. And you can see the covers, the facsimile pages of the covers of those two design portfolios here behind me. The project's architectural character, as you can see, one could best describe as a kind of locally adapted neo-functionalism. Credited with the authorship of those projects are Jaakko Laapotti, Pertti Solla, and Eero Valjakka, as well as in each case, a group of students from Helsinki's technical universities. As their cover pages reveal, these portfolios stem from the third and fourth Hannes Meyer seminar held at the Bauhaus Dessau in May 1982 and 1984. Now, how can we make sense of the inclusion of those portfolios in the Leipzig Trade Fair, an important site of exchange between socialist and capitalist countries, East and West during the Cold War? How did they come into being? Which purpose did they serve? What were the Hannes Meyer seminars, and why were Finnish architects designing in East Germany in the first place? My talk today seeks to answer those questions by focusing on the productive appropriation of the Bauhaus Dessau as a site for creative and intellectual production following its reconstruction by the East German leadership in 1976. From the late 1970s until the fall of the wall, the iconic building was used first sporadically and since 1984 officially as a training center for architects, designers, and artists. It hosted a series of international and interdisciplinary design seminars, chief among them the Hannes Meyer seminars from 1980 to 1986, and then subsequently the Walter Gropius seminars between 1987 and 1991. These seminars, as I'd like to show, not only established a contact zone between East German practitioners and their colleagues from Finland, later also Sweden, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and West Germany, as well as, of course, socialist countries such as Czechoslovakia, Poland, or Vietnam, they also created a space for reform debates as their organizers and participants put forward alternative, urban, more differentiated, flexible, sustainable, and to some extent also user-oriented strategies that sought to counter the socialist leadership's aesthetically, economically, and ecologically exhausted mass housing program. So my goal will be to discuss to what extent attempts to productively engage the modernist legacy by focusing on design, creativity, and invention, or intellectual labor, beyond the dichotomy of form and technology, may have been grounded in a sense of dissatisfaction with the official East German Bauhaus reception since 1976 that was shared among a group of younger architects. In other words, while the administrators of ideology, as Wolfgang Kiel called them later, rejected the Bauhaus as quote-unquote formalist and cosmopolitan for the largest part of the 1950s and 1960s, their abrupt embrace of the school now foregrounded technological and economic aspects such as standardization, mass construction, prefabrication, efficiency, rationalization, etc., in order to legitimize the leadership's own fixation on industrialized building production. The architectural theorist Olaf Weber, one of Bernd Grönwald's colleagues, criticized this view as complacent, lazy, and positivist. He noted, quote, "It is not primarily factual, but methodical knowledge that can be gained from an institution which was active half a century ago. Not styles, techniques, or hopes, not that which was new back then, but that which helped to identify the new. We should not just do research about the Bauhaus, but in the spirit of the Bauhaus. That is, we should use the experience of the Bauhaus to solve our own structural, functional, and, above all, design problems." So similarly, Bernd Grönwald then argued that it was vital, again, this is a quote, "to establish new qualitative design parameters in response to social needs and contemporary conditions of production, especially given the degree to which economic concerns have come to govern and interfere in the design process in East Germany," unquote. Plans to reopen the historic Bauhaus building as a center dedicated to design practice dated back to the 1960s after a first attempt by Dessau's mayor Fritz Hesse and former Bauhaus student Hubert Hoffmann to re-establish the school in 1946 had failed. Debates about the status of the Bauhaus as a monument with international significance in East Germany first resurfaced then in 1962. And what you can see here is basically an article that Bruno Fliehl, the East German architectural theorist, had written in 1963 as chief editor of the East German architectural journal Deutsche Architektur, which was then subsequently banned from publication. And in that article, Fliehl alludes to these efforts to reconstruct the Bauhaus building in Dessau in East Germany in that particular moment in time. So over the course of the following years leading up to its 40th anniversary, more precise proposals for the reconstruction and future use of the building were considered in the fragile climate of economic and cultural reforms. And among the actors that were involved in their development were, for instance, the Swiss architect and director of the Institute for Theory and History of Architecture at the Bauakademie, Hans Schmidt, the architectural historian Kurt Junghans, the former Gropius employee Richard Paulig, the director of the Bauakademie, Gerhard Kosel, Dessau's city architect Karl-Heinz Schlesier, but also the director of the Central Institute for Industrial Design, Martin Kelm, and East Germany's Minister of Culture, Hans Benzin. Those discussions were, of course, very, very much shaped by Cold War politics, but also, as we shall see, by internal conflicts. Schmidt, for instance, framed his calls for reconstruction in both practical and ideological terms. Not only had recent Soviet historiography come to recognize the school's significance for creative production, West Germany, he warned, meanwhile also laid claim to modernist heritage with the foundation of the Bauhaus Archive in Darmstadt in 1960. Junghans's plea to rebuild the Bauhaus building stressed above all its reputation and therefore its role in the foreign perception of East German cultural policy. Noting that the building's poor state, along with its current inadequate use, it was home to different vocational schools, provoked negative comments by a growing number of Western visitors. One of those visitors, as is well known, was the Italian historian Leonardo Benevolo, who included a contemporary photograph of the Bauhaus in its state of decay in East Germany in his 1964 public history of modern architecture. So Junghans then argued that reconstruction and reuse were crucial to improving the GDR's international standing. And according to an internal report, the school was to become a center for socialist cultural and educational policy. It should house an archive, exhibition spaces to facilitate exchange between East and West, but also provide facilities for the training of prospective city architects and talented junior staff in district construction offices, host seminars for construction officials, as well as foster interdisciplinary collaboration between architects, artists, and industrial designers. And it's this aspect that I'm going to focus on a bit more. The administration of Dessau embraced those plans. However, behind the scenes, a conflict of interest over the building's use soon ensued, which seemed to echo a more fundamental split between economic and cultural politics within East Germany at the time. And perhaps that split was to some extent also prefigured already within the Bauhaus itself. East Germany's Minister of Culture, Hans Benzin, not only advocated a gradual move of the Hochschule für Industrielle Formgestaltung Burg Giebichenstein from Halle to the refurbished Bauhaus Dessau, he had also made plans for a symposium with surviving Bauhaus members on the occasion of the school's anniversary without consulting representatives of the Bauakademie. It was his ministry, too, that had provided initial funds for a detailed survey of the building that was carried out in 1964 by students from Weimar under the supervision of former Bauhaus student and architect Konrad Püschel, as well as for minor structural repairs. Yet in the end, neither Benzin's nor the plans of the Bauakademie officials materialized. Lack of funding to rehouse the building's current occupants, if one is to believe official records at least, put an end to their efforts to revive the school. The ideological backlash of the socialist unity, socialist democrat, the socialist the SED's, sorry, 11th plenum in December 1965 that undid many of the early 1960s reform, as we know, may have been another or in fact the actual reason behind this. So then another decade passed until the building was finally listed and restored, and in the meantime, Bauhaus scholarship in the GDR had advanced and the ideological climate become more favorable to the school's rehabilitation. In 1976, the so-called Wissenschaftlich-Kulturelles Zentrum opened to the public with an exhibition that sought to link now the progressive heritage of the Bauhaus to the development of town planning, architecture, and design in the GDR. So this kind of connection that I mentioned in the introduction already that was criticized by that younger generation of architects became very much kind of visible here. The Amt für Industrielle Formgestaltung, AIF, and the HAB Weimar, the Hochschule für Architektur und Bauwesen, used parts of the building as professional training centers, much as had been envisioned in the mid-1960s already. Both institutions then increasingly expanded their activities at the Bauhaus Dessau during the late 1970s and early 1980s, hosting several workshops in collaboration with organizations such as the International Council of Societies of Industrial Design, or ICSID, and what you can see here is the interdesign workshop that took place at the Bauhaus Dessau in 1979 on playgrounds. A more decisive shift then into the domain of East German construction occurred with the opening of the Bildungszentrum Bauhaus Dessau, which was subordinate to the Bauakademie 8 years later in April 1984. The architect and theorist Bernd Grönwald, whom I mentioned already, played a pivotal role in this process. As professor for architectural theory, Grönwald had already been involved in the foundation of the International Bauhaus Colloquia in Weimar in 1976. And following his move to the Bauakademie in East Berlin 10 years later, as the director of the Institut für Städtebau und Architektur and vice president of the Academy, he occupied a strategic position in the centralized and bureaucratic structures of East German construction. The ambitions of the Bildungszentrum were basically to improve the aesthetic quality, quote unquote, of the city as a whole, and to bring East German construction up to speed with international developments, including the use of CAD-CAM, and to increase designers' competitiveness by promoting experimentation and innovation, something which stood in strong contrast to the day-to-day routine of architects who were employed in district housing offices, yeah, or in the Wohnungsbaukombinate. So to avoid the risk of the Bildungszentrum becoming yet another outgrowth of the technocratic construction sector, its first leader was actually a civil engineer. Grönwald then sought to appoint a young expert in housing and urban design as the new director of the Bauhaus Dessau. So in March 1987, Rolf Kuhn, an urban planner and sociologist who had just finished a postdoctoral dissertation in which he critically examined the social and urban impact of East German mass housing since the early 1970s, was awarded this position. After mapping out these different institutional changes that provided the backdrop to the six Hannes Meyer seminars that were held between 1980 and 1986, I now want to turn to the seminars themselves. And doing so, I seek to show how the emphasis on intellectual labor or design at the Bauhaus Dessau during the 1980s was entangled with transnational exchanges and technology exports between countries such as Finland and the GDR. The aim of the seminars was both simple and seemingly impossible: to present decision makers and planners at the local level, and that is in district construction offices such as Dessau, Erfurt, or Leipzig, with alternative solutions for urban housing, and to be sure local bureaucrats and construction officials frequently rejected these proposals that the architects made as unworkable. Designs were not only to respond to the urban context of their site, but also to fulfill the needs of quote-unquote developed socialist society, chiefly by accommodating a greater degree of flexibility. while also following the principle of industrialized construction. And according to Grönwald, who directed the seminars from 1983 to 86, the established methods of building production were not so much to be rejected as they required deliberate qualitative improvements. For him, quote unquote, there was no alternative to mass-produced architecture. At the same time, he argued, there ought not to be any restrictions to design. Given these ambitions, we might then ask what actually qualified Finland, or more precisely these Finnish architects and researchers, as particularly suitable partners in this undertaking. One obvious reason might be the country's political position in the Cold War. Prior to officially recognizing the GDR in 1973, Finland maintained economic, trade, and cultural relationships with both parts of Germany, however, below the level of formal diplomacy. While there existed sporadic contacts in architecture and construction, at least since the late 1950s, these remained singular attempts until the end of the 1960s, when within the framework of an attempted cultural agreement between Finland and East Germany, the country's professional associations, the SAFA and BDA, began to cooperate. The outcome of that cooperation was an exhibition an exhibition by the Museum of Finnish Architecture that was held in June 1970 in East Berlin. And I'm sorry, I'm missing the image of the catalog here. Shows like these increased the appreciation of Finnish modern design and architecture among East German designers, its sensibility for landscape in particular. The second reason, and vice versa, this might be here, there appeared to be an openness, even affinity towards socialism among Finnish architects and planners, many of whom identified with left-wing politics. In 1976, the subgroup Democratic Architects was founded within SAFA, modeled on a similar organization of left-wing lawyers. And as a third reason, Finland, as you can see in these images, possessed extensive knowledge as well as advanced technological systems for industrialized construction, and it was those systems that proved to be particularly valuable in that exchange. Between 1968 and 1970, the organization of the Finnish concrete industry commissioned the so-called BES study in an effort to implement a unified open construction system. And at the same time, in East Germany, in the context of a centrally managed economy, similar attempts to develop a unified construction system in order to rationalize production by narrowing down the palette of earlier, often locally developed prefabrication systems was underway. The resulting WBS, or Wohnungsbauserie 70, was employed then in the vast majority of East German housing projects during the 1970s and 1980s. As Finland then began to experience a downturn in concrete construction in the early 1970s, the corporation Partek Oy increased its export activities to up to about 40% of its total business, especially to the former Comecon countries, yeah, to the countries of the Warsaw Pact, but then later also to the Third World. In 1974, Finland and the GDR then signed the first contract for the delivery of two high-capacity concrete panel plants, and the ink on those contracts had barely been dried as criticism of systems building then surfaced on both sides, as we can see in those cartoons here, yeah, the one on the left-hand side from Finland and the one on the right-hand side from East Germany, roughly dating about the same time from the mid-1970s. So against this background, in 1976, Finland and the GDR then agreed on what was called a scientific technological cooperation, which established connections between professorships at the technical universities of Tampere and Helsinki and the Hochschule für Architektur und Bauwesen in Weimar. Tasked with managing this cooperation on behalf of Finland was Pertti Solla, one of the architects of the schemes in Dessau, and Erfurt, because he had studied architecture in Karlsruhe and worked as an assistant for Egon Eiermann between 1954 and 61. The first outcome, again, of this cooperation was an exhibition on Finnish housing design that was accompanied by a symposium on way of life and living standards, housing and the living environment, which was held in Weimar in 1979, and a sort of set of well-made catalogs, but also a documentation of that conference, have been published. Now, that same year, the architect Jaakko Laupoti edited a study to adapt the BES system so as to meet demands for increased flexibility and variation, for instance, when building in urban contexts, and this was precisely the task that those architects faced at the Bauhaus Dessau. Alongside his Finnish colleagues then, Solla, the urban planner Eero Valjaka, in collaboration with different East German practitioners, including, for instance, Iris Reuter, yeah, who is now Bremen Senate Building Director, Laupoti participated in these two Hannes Meyer seminars. The third one in 1982, in which the team proposed basically seven different infill housing types for urban perimeter blocks in the Mulde Vorstadt Dessau, and the locations were basically sort of difficult to resolve corner locations of these perimeter blocks or kind of bombed out building sites. And the fourth, these are the elevations of the projects that one of the types of the projects that was developed for those sites. And the fourth seminar in 1984, where the plans basically comprised a hotel as well as various residential and mixed-use buildings in the historic center of Erfurt. In each instance and for each location, the architects had developed a specific urban and architectural design solution based on the adaptation of the BES system that was adapted to local conditions. Now, what this suggests, this kind of use of the BES system, is basically, perhaps unsurprisingly, that the industry partner of those Finnish architects, Patek Oy, may not have acted without self-interest, and this was a fact that also didn't escape East German bureaucrats either. So although the latter, in a way, kind of commended the quality of the Finnish designs, they were clear that the implementation of those projects with imported Partec BES technology would not be tenable, so none of those projects were actually realized. As records show, officials in the Ministry of Construction had rather set their eyes on a very different target, and that target was basically joint Finnish and East German construction projects in third countries and other countries, including in the third world. And therefore, to conclude, it thus appears as though what counted in the end really was the acquisition in this process of design and technical knowledge as a potentially marketable skill that could be sold, that could be marketed in the context of a fledgling East German economy in the 1980s. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Maxi for organizing this and the invitation and for meeting new colleagues from the CCSA. I'm happy to be part of this conversation. And I should say that I'm not a historian of Bauhaus architecture, but I've encountered, I would say, a persistent theme in the historiography of modern architecture that I want to address this evening. That is that America inspired what you might call the persistent will to standardization in European construction. I see the discourse around the Bauhaus then in this regard as an especially good path for actually reconsidering what we might call the American precedent. And I do this in order to extract what I would consider to be new lessons about how modernist architects appropriated practices from the mid-19th century to justify their dream for a standardized future. As we see in the galleries upstairs, if you've already visited them, early in the 20th century, construction workers had begun to adopt methods from large-scale industry. And so when architects looked for an origin point for these changes, especially European architects, they pointed to the American wood frame, known as the balloon frame, a technique that had already translated, in their mind, industrial standards into a construction system. According to the German architect, Konrad Wachsmann, for example, it was the simplicity of the frame's parts and assembly that had laid the basis for converting houses into industrially produced commodities. Mass-produced materials were central to his understanding of the efficiency that they brought to the labor process. So in Holz Hausbau, published in 1930, he wrote, "The American typically buys from a catalog in which a fixed price is stated, just as for an automobile or for any other industrial product. The building materials are then delivered to the construction site, carefully packed, sorted, and numbered, and all the necessary tools, nails, paint, etc., are also provided. Using then such exactly machined materials, anyone can, without assistance, assemble and construct his own house." So Wachsmann viewed these so-called ready-cut houses, which had been produced for a couple of decades by the Sears Roebuck and Company, as direct extensions of the ballooning technique that he traced back to the middle of the 19th century. With a variation on these so-called machine-made houses, he then hoped to capture European market for a similar product, specifically in Germany, through mass-produced wood house construction. That's what his book was about. Siegfried Gideon also shared Wachsmann's view that the balloon frame represented an early instance of translating construction into an industrial system. 19th century innovations in American industries of tool making, automated nail cutting, and lumber milling were central to Gideon's belief that American ingenuity had developed this early standardized building technique. And this is his reference back to the balloon frame as a form of industrialization in the pages of Space, Time, and Architecture. To his mind, this general emphasis on machinery opened the new nation in the mid-19th century to a more rapid industrialization by avoiding the lag that had been brought about by the craft guilds found in Europe. So without the organized resistance of artisans to technological change, by his logic, industrialists could more easily set labor on a scientific basis by standardizing practices that were otherwise left to the traditional techniques of skilled craftsmen. Thus, what I'm trying to show you here is that both Gideon and Wachsmann, German language speakers, used the balloon frame as an example of standardization of construction in order to clarify what they understood to be architecture's incipient modernity. And they viewed that frame as an icon of standardization, which would usher in a sort of 20th century model of a totally standardized future. Unfortunately, the history doesn't quite play out the way that they told it. The balloon frame was in fact never standard. And so the sort of mythology that I want to sort of unravel today is this mythology of the American standardized industrial precedent. And I'm going to destabilize that already in the pages of the Architectural Graphic Standards from 1932, which were put together by Ramsey and Sleeper, where the illustrations, although they were standardized in their isometric representation, had variations of the frame already built in into this standardized graphic formula. Based on a list of distinguishing parts, which you would find in the sort of textual element of the graphic standards book, you would see that there, in fact, were relatively significant differences between a braced frame, a Western frame, or a balloon frame. And if you thought the balloon frame appeared to be the basis of the others, if you took a closer inspection of the other two, you'd see that variations among them were actually largely linked maybe to more regional practices and not to any kind of variation on a theme. So due to the modernist assumption that balloon frames were industrially standardized, I think too little attention has been placed on how these variations already indicate a certain kind of limit on the architect's engagement in construction, how they already, make evident a boundary, between what we might call intellectual labor and practical labor. So what I'm going to show you today is the history of a particular form of paperwork that Maxi already told you about, which is called the specification, which I want to use in order to show how American architectural practice, in fact, managed to build this boundary between intellectual and manual labor. It's based on this bureaucratic instrument that the frame could actually be defined both as a conceptual and a material object. It's this instrument that offered a form of mediation through a kind of bureaucracy of paperwork. So here's the thesis of the talk, which is that standards, insofar as they exist, only exist through the procedures that are enacted through office work, and that architects, over the span of the late 19th century in the US, took on more and more clerical labor in order that perhaps they could communicate with their builders in a way that then Europeans would come to call standardized. So I want to destabilize the idea that American construction was always already standard, or even for that matter, standardized even by the 1932 when these drawings were published. In order to do this, we have to start with the history of the specification. Like, where did it come from? This is one specification, one of the first of its type from 1718, one published well before specifications had been used in architectural practice in the US in particular, although they were in use in other architectural practices in continental Europe, where there was a profession of architecture. The law that was guiding English patents, in fact, required specifications on that date in 1718 as a supplement to drawings. So in this case, James Puckle's design for a machine gun was a kind of early example of what they called an instrument in writing that indicated its practical method of operation. So this actually adding of words to images formed a kind of legal precedent that carried over into patent law in the newly independent United States. So beginning in the 1790s, American tool builders in the former colonies wrote specifications for their patents to describe machines that produced everything from saws to cut nails to dimension lumber, which is all the stuff that Gideon tells us is the reason why the balloon frame came to exist in the US in the first place. Before specifications, in other words, before they were applied to architectural practice and were still only used, let's say, in patent law, American architectural practice was guided only by two things, contracts and drawings. For example, in a contract drawn up or written up in 1799 between the architect Benjamin Henry Latrobe and the contractor of the Bank of Pennsylvania, the contract stipulated that all the drawings would be followed exactly, but in the case of a failure that resulted from the discrepancy of the building's physical execution from the drawings, the fault would be assigned to the builder. But if the drawings proved to be incorrect, which is to say structurally unsound, liability would then land on the architect. The problem that Latrobe saw in that system is that it gave way too much agency to the builder and too little control to the architect over how the building would get built. So despite the fact that we ascribe, let's say, the building of the Bank of Pennsylvania to Latrobe, he felt that he didn't have enough control. So specifications would have perhaps given him a little bit more agency in the actual construction of his design. So I want to show you a little bit of the history of how this paperwork came into being. Before its existence, we can see that carpenters began to exhibit increasing interest in acquiring the skills of architectural drawing. Builders collected images and texts in what they called pattern books beginning in the 1830s to publicize the knowledge of classical architecture. Books, for example, like this one by Asher Benjamin, served to conventionalize knowledge of various construction techniques, so sashes and windows, for example. And he called the book The Architect or The Practical House Carpenter. It was such a popular book that it actually was issued 17 times between 1830 and 1857. And in it, he described the classical five orders. And this is really just to instruct carpenters in the proportions of those details because they didn't have access to those buildings in the United States. It also then, as you can see, so that's the Doric order on the left. On the right, also instructed carpenters in how to assemble simple elements in wood construction. But the title, The Architect or the Practical House Carpenter, doesn't differentiate between the architect and the carpenter. In fact, it makes explicit the still unresolved professional status of architects in the United States. And there were no specifications included in the book, which is a clear sign that Benjamin did not acknowledge any difference in the knowledge he had from that of an architect. But one book that did include specifications, not the first, but among the first, was written by Richard Upjohn. It's called Rural Architecture and published in 1852, actually 5 years before he co-founded the American Institute of Architects, which was the first professional organization to regulate that practice in the United States. So the book illustrated four of his designs, which you can see a wooden church, also a chapel, a schoolhouse, a parsonage, none of which were given a specific location beyond their rural surroundings depicted in perspective drawings like this one. But the stated purpose of the book was to provide designs for what he's called cheap but still substantial buildings for the nation's westward expansion. So the designs were devised to broaden the influence of his already successful New York practice. And the book indicates then a significant advance in the architect's status in the US. It staged an explicit reliance of the design's graphic representation on written specifications in order to transmit the architect's intellectual labor over a distance and maintain control of the built outcome. Upjohn specifications, which you could peruse here, but continue for some pages thereafter, were always stated in the most general terms. The materials and the labor required to execute each of his designs was included therein, and the openness of their tone became a kind of common, let's say, fact or rhetoric for the specifications that were written by architects to direct builders from across the continent. Why were they written generally? And I'll go into this more as you see in the future, is that the builders who were to receive these specifications from wherever they were located would always have to adapt the design to some kind of regional conditions. So I just want to show you, for example, some of the drawings that were included, but many of the drawings that were excluded from the book leave open to the imagination what the builder might actually do in the actual execution of this, for example, the parsonage, the wooden chapel. But there was a book written by a carpenter with specifications, and that's this one by Edward Shaw from 1854, so it's still a couple of years before the AIA is formed, and it's called The Modern Architect or Every Carpenter His Own Master. So it's written by a carpenter for carpenters to become architects. And this, which is his third book, actually, in his view, according to the preface, sort of identifies Shaw as no longer just a carpenter, but now also an architect. Thus, he transformed his identity as a result of his developing expertise in what he called the theoretical practice and science of architectural drawings and plans, both ancient and modern. And through the wide dissemination of the book, he offered, it would potentially allow every carpenter to shift his identity to become, as you can see, his own master. Of course, you can imagine this is 10 years before the American Civil War, at the moment at which being one's own master would, of course, be the sort of political topic of the day, because the emancipation of the slaves in the 1860s is something that you can imagine the carpenters identifying already as a kind of emancipatory desire. So if you take a closer look at this frontispiece, you can begin to see the message that is being sent by the book, where an implied transfer of knowledge is being conducted from the seated man, who's obviously the architect with a top hat and a coat, who's instructing the carpenters, who are dressed in vests, standing beside a drawing, and another craftsman is sawing a piece of lumber for a partially completed wood frame that's in the background, and he works to realize the design found in the drawing on discussion. So while the carpenters stand beside the architect to watch him perform his knowledge with the classical instruments of compass and rule, behind them, behind him, sits an open box of carpenter's tools, some chisels, a drill with its bits, and an axe propped up against the box. So by comparison to the unwieldy materials or of the craftsman and the giant sort of box of tools, the architect's tools fit in the palms of his hand, and a folio of his drawings sit at his feet, which are testament to his modern authorial identity. As a gentleman which Shaw identified as having theoretical practice in science, he is free from the toil of construction, and his mobility allows him to instruct rather than work with his hands. He instructs with his hands, like a good professor should, and he earns this sort of self-determining power of what you might call theoretical knowledge or intellectual labor. Another carpenter, William Bell, later on then goes on to describe for the first time the balloon frame as a geometrical system that could be normalized, but it's not until the frame appears in George E. Woodward's book, which is called Country Homes, earlier published in a kind of gardening journal called The Cultivator in 1860, that this, let's say, the frame gains its reputation as a kind of theoretical system. And the words are as follows from Woodward. The balloon frame, he says, belongs to no one person. Nobody claims it as an invention, and yet, in the art of construction, it is one of the most sensible improvements that has ever been made. Craft, in other words, these are my words, not his, is the common property of all architects and builders. It's not an invention, meaning that the frame could not be patented. It's not even patentable. It's not intellectual property. Therefore, Woodward's so-called partial isometrical perspective is not an image that belonged to the knowledge of carpentry or an image that belonged to the knowledge of architecture, but rather it's a visual and verbal description of a technique that helps expand the domain of, in Woodward's practice, and perhaps more profitably his publishing enterprise, because people would want to know more about this craft technique. The drawing was then followed by diagrams of various connections in the frame, details that illustrated, in this case, the manner of nailing or the manner of so-called splicing, the manner of tying such a structure together, which is a sort of set of didactic images, that is to say, a kind of learning tool for establishing ballooning as a system that could then be applied to a building of nearly any plan as high as three stories. He included this as the appendix to his book, which included any number of designs, I don't remember how many, and you can imagine that he implied that you could build any one of those designs through this same sort of building technique. What's important is to realize that as much as it's setting up the system as a kind, or let's just say ballooning as a system, it's not defining it as a standard technique. It's offering variability to the builder and to the architect to maintain this as a kind of plastic model for construction of a house of any shape and nearly any size. In 1869, then, Woodward publishes what he calls The National Architect, which is a more extensive monograph with, as the title implies, corresponding to the kind of geographic extension of his influence across the continent. It includes, then, designs for a country, for the country house, for a suburban house, or a village house. And each of the 19 fully elaborated house designs, I think 19 being fewer than the ones in the earlier country houses, he writes, in addition to the designs, he includes a set of carpenters and masons and plumbers' specifications. So while the drawings became very specific and very specific to the design of a house, he offered always a set of kind of general specifications that would guide the builder in realizing those house designs according to their regional needs. So what is specific is the drawing, and what is general, actually, despite the word, is the specification. So you, as the builder would, or the architect could begin to kind of draw from this book and use it selectively and use the specifications, editing them at will, adapting them to the particularities of the region. They would mediate the architect's ideas and identify their role as the builder as occupying that of practical knowledge. So one sort of important anecdote here before I sort of reach my conclusion is that in Woodward's office, a guy called Elisha Hussey emerges as a kind of important, as it were, a kind of data manager of the late 19th century, who produces a set of specifications to guide builders at a distance, but incorporating, as he calls them, the facts from across the United States in a trip that he took in 1874 from New York to San Francisco. So just an anecdote here, you can see, and it's hard to see, I'm imagining, but that the cost of lumber in Amherst, Massachusetts is $30 per m. But in Appleton, Wisconsin, it's $14, which is to say half the price. And so what Hussey's offering the architect here is the capacity to then be able to predict the cost of the house that he's designed in New York or in Amherst or in Appleton, and the variability of that cost in order to be able to actually incorporate that form of estimation into the professional sort of auspice of an architect. So these are extremely elaborate specifications which offer the architect more and more control over the over what was available in the regional each region. For example, in sheathing paper, you can find certain kinds in Virginia versus other kinds in New York, and he wants to differentiate their capacities, which is to say that there's a kind of ever-growing, let's say, data management and data incorporation into the actual practice and life of the architectural office. Hussey's book and his work for Woodward then indicate a general trend, I would say, in architectural offices toward the end of the 19th century, toward data collection. More clerical positions were dedicated to arranging such paperwork and managing the distribution of office tasks, a shift that generally illustrates the emergence of what I would consider to be a hybrid quality of architectural work against what you might call the seemingly unified task of design, one that we now inherit from the sort of Bauhaus pedagogy of the 20th century. So again, just to restate the thesis here before I conclude, I want this idea that standardization is a part of the office procedures of the late 19th century American practice to a little bit frustrate the way in which the Bauhaus dealt with standards as a way of making design ever more clear and ever more pure. So the differences, I would say, between the plans of these two large architectural practices provide, finally, evidence of that trend, where Burnham and Root's Chicago offices in the Rookery Building in 1893 are on the left. You can look at Albert Kahn's Detroit offices in the Marquette Building from 1918. While Burnham's office included a gymnasium for the gentlemanly architect and a small library that included a mix of books on classical buildings and technical manuals, there was a central area even for clerks and bookkeepers, typewriters, and a telephone, but the office generally feels a bit more social and studio-like. By contrast, then, once the gentlemanly identity of the architect has been secured, a larger image of the Kahn office shows us 25 years later how much space, the quantity of space that's devoted to paperwork has vastly expanded. The gymnasium's gone, the library's gone, and there's actually a room now for storing specifications. One whole other room for storing specification typists who produce the specifications. And those rooms are positioned between one of the two drafting rooms and the designer's office. In other words, chosen as a kind of convenient location of communication, an interface between what you might call the conceptual work of design and the integration of data for the industrially produced construction materials on the other hand. In fact, This is just some of the paperwork that was then profiled in an architectural review article about the Kahn offices. 18 pieces of paperwork were selected to be profiled. I will end with an image here of a stripped-down modern factory actually designed by the office of Albert Kahn, which reminds us of the Bauhausler's interest in American industrial architecture. In fact, it's an image, of course, made by Isa Gropius, which evokes the prevailing historiography of the school's interest in the American application of standards to mass production. But I hope this talk has shown that the American precedent was far more complex than the old modernist historiography that Gropius and others pervade. Rather than standardized construction systems, architects in the U.S. relied on a growing infrastructure of office routines, especially the writing of specifications that developed around the tasks of architectural design since the middle of the 19th century.
Thank you very much for these fascinating talks, and let's sit down and turn to the panel discussion. Thank you very much for these two looks into before the Bauhaus in your case, and how we have to revise our ideas of modernity as we love it, so to speak, and you presenting us this idea of the spirit of the Bauhaus, and I'd like to go into that or to look into more depth later, but just to begin with, I'd like to start with a very general question, namely, what does the Bauhaus mean to you?
Well, I mean, I think the talk a little bit shows that, which is, for me, the Bauhaus represents a historiography of modernism, and it's one that we assume we know. And what I think is nice about having a new view of the Bauhaus is that, in fact, all of those amazing myths that were developed in order to purify and clarify architecture for modern life are just that. They're myths. And insofar as myths are history, and history is about myth-making, I think it's about time, 100 years later, to try and devise a new set of myths. That isn't to say our hope is that they're closer to what you might call the truth, reality, as it were. But that isn't to say that those myths weren't as powerful as they were, but just to sort of unground them from their sense of self-certainty. So that's what it really is, an opportunity. The Bauhaus to me is an opportunity to do a new historiography of modernism.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I would sort of answer by going in a similar but at the same time sort of slightly different direction, sort of less perhaps in the direction of historiography and epistemology, but sort of more in the direction of kind of the Bauhaus and its sort of various kind of afterlives, hidden figures, which still, I think, provides an incredibly kind of rich ground to kind of go on, you know. And I think these sort of different afterlives, reimaginations of the Bauhaus are also something that I've been kind of interested in, mm-hmm. in my work, is sort of how people have kind of reappropriated those yes. ideas in different kind of, you know, social and political contexts. In East Germany, the story, of course, is also kind of connected to a number of people who have been, in a way, sort of ignored, written out, were not part of the official narratives of the Bauhaus, you know, characters like Pauli or Kuschel and so on, who are now kind of slowly are being rediscovered, who have a sort of bring with them a very kind of rich history of migrations to countries in Asia, China, North Korea, in Kuschel's case, and so on. And I think, you know, this in a way also provides a kind of very rich ground for rewriting some of those, kind of taken for granted knowledges, you know, that the Bauhaus in a way exists in this bind between Europe and North America, that there's also a whole other world of the Bauhaus and of sort of different lives of the Bauhaus that have existed in other locations.
And well, speaking of appropriation, I'm interested and also fascinated by when you explained that there was sort of the spirit of the Bauhaus, and I think that was in the 1970s when they started or when they planned the design seminars, and when actors like Bernd Grönewald, I guess, were in charge, so to speak. And so I was just wondering how much socialism was present at all, or in other words, was there something like the spirit of the Prague Spring as well, so that you could say they tried to create a modernity with a human face, if that's appropriate for you?
No, I mean, I think that term, modernity with a human face, which obviously kind of links to Alexander Dubček's kind of notion of socialism with a human face, this idea of the Prague Spring, of kind of the spirit of the reform movement, which I think in a way also kind of characterizes a lot of what is going on in East Germany in the 1960s already, and which in a way is also a sort of part of a history that has yet to be written, and then to some extent also kind of lives on over the course of the 1970s. I mean, of course, the party, the official kind of leadership, takes back a lot of the reforms that, for instance, under Walter Ulbricht are being implemented, economic reforms, cultural reforms, where sort of new things are being tested out, also new knowledge is being brought in. There's a whole sort of engagement, for instance, with cybernetics and organization theory in 1960s East Germany.
Which maybe brings us to workflow.
then sort of, in a way, is kind of being, sort of taken back again in the 1970s. But it sort of does, in a way, sort of live on, particularly in the kind of, you know, academic world and the sort of more closed off spheres, I guess, that are a little bit sort of further away from where kind of light generally shines. And I mean, this is also, I guess, where my interest in these sort of slightly kind of marginal episodes sort of small groups that in a way kind of existed outside, you know, that of course nobody was kind of outside of sort of official politics, but where in a way sort of people managed to sort of carve out spaces for discussion.
And speaking of how political the institution is, I was wondering, Michael, do you understand the architect's anxiety that you described, or was it an anti-democratic term,
I think the architects were as I'm trying to make a connection here between the two parts, because I think what both of us are working on is a kind of using the clarity of the architecture itself and of the architecture manifestos that came out from the Bauhaus as a foil against which I think whether it's marginal practices or the infiltration of a highly complex geopolitics or the politics, as it were, of the of an assumed harmony between builder and architect, which actually, at least in the case that assumption was not true for sure was it was not true in the United States, where they assumed that that harmony existed. Were the architects disruptive to the sort of democratic impulses of the builders? Probably the builders themselves would have been disruptive to those democratic impulses. There wasn't any kind of utopia on the horizon. But the architects did use intellectual labor as a way of distancing themselves and offering themselves an elite relationship. One that I think also is the way in which the Bauhaus was able to then export its model to various countries all over the world, whether they were socialist or not, in fact. So that the Bauhaus traveled as a kind of elite program outside from a kind of center into a kind of system of orbiting elements. And I think, I mean, Thorsten's model is an interesting kind of redemocratization, as it were, of something that seems to have gotten so clarified and purified at in the 20s when we're so aware of what the Bauhaus spoke of itself, and we take its sort of story for granted. So I love that contrast.
And maybe, let's stay a little bit at that point and historiography. So I was wondering, I mean, you two both talk about, how to rewrite and sort of write against this myth and so on. And I was wondering, what can we do to change this view of the Bauhaus? How can we adapt that more into the general historiography, especially now at the centennial?
My first response would be that actually if both sides, the origin and the afterlife, are as muddy as they appear to be, there's no chance that the thing in the center was anything but muddy. You know, and that, as you say, we write out certain things that make the story harder and harder to tell. I think that the complication of the story of what the Bauhaus was in its actual heyday would be a really great disruptive history to write as well. I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if one ever kind of gets close to that sort of, or, you know, is able to approximate this kind of reality of what the Bauhaus in its heyday would have been. But I mean, I suppose, what I've been kind of interested in and what I was always sort of engaging with, or, you know, had to engage with in a way through my work, was to also read these historiographies of the Bauhaus that in a way are very localized and not that well known, that are also in a way sort of extremely politically tainted to a large extent, but at the same time also responded to the context in which they kind of originated. So for instance, the work of Kurt Junghans, and then this sort of these episodes where suddenly kind of architectural historians from Eastern Europe and Western Europe meet, you know, or when people like Marco De Michelis and Francesco Dalco kind of travel in 1976 to the first Bauhaus colloquia, you know, and before already the Italian architects kind of visit East Germany and so on, you know, and what is the interest, what do they see, how are these kind of worlds in a way also kind of able to communicate to each other? Are they speaking about the same thing, about the same Bauhaus, the same kind of modernism, or are they talking about two completely different things? And this was, in a way, the story that I was getting, for instance, between, this sort of very odd meeting between Manfredo Tafuri and Kurt Junghans, when Kurt Junghans travels to Venice, is invited by Manfredo Tafuri, and then, you know, talks about the emigre Bauhäuslers who basically went to work in the Soviet Union, and Tafuri then sort of writes in his notebook, yeah, you know, I mean, Schmidt and all of these guys, Junghans, you know, they're just these kind of naive modernists and so on. But for Junghans, in a way, also this excavation of the biography of Bruno Taut and so on is a way of sort of engaging with the realities, often also the restrictions, and I really feel that he writes those books very much also talking to practitioners around him, and it's this kind of balance of sort of carving out, you know, when Tafuri sort of wants to move away from practice, Junghans, who is locked in a position where architectural history is considered totally irrelevant, by the officials in the Bauakademie, sort of tries to make a space for architectural history to become somehow sort of operative, or to become, to have some sort of influence, to have some kind of meaning. And yeah, these sort of frictions, or where worlds kind of don't meet, is what I find interesting, and both of them sort of call themselves Marxist architectural historians, and sometimes sort of work also with the same, not necessarily the same methods, but with the same approach and the same ethos, and that, yeah, that I find interesting.
And did you, Michael, stumble across any perceptions of German architects, carpenters, sources in your research?
Yeah, I mean, this, what's peculiar about this particular kind of wooden frame is that it's inherited from a Northern European craft tradition. So there are now, well, I would say in the 80s, there was a very strong interest in sort of tracing craft back to its origin points in certain kind of European craft traditions. So to say that the, in fact, what was an apparent standard construction technique had actually come from a craft technique borrowed from Northern Europe. I don't particularly care for that, because the idea is that there's a kind of heritage, that craft moves from one embodied culture to another embodied culture, and I find that that disqualifies, let's say, the kind of, let's say, labor politics that I was interested in profiling, or the geopolitics, for example, that I think Torsten is interested in. So in a way, the kind of migration of a kind of embodied knowledge from one geography to the next, and its transformations, perhaps, I think sort of coasts above both those political registers. So yeah, I have found that there's a kind of always this lurking European world behind the American colony, but I want to kind of undermine that as much as possible by situating it within a very specific kind of, in this case, post-colonial.
Which you do quite successfully, I would say. to connect, have you, Torsten, saw anything or have any idea of the internal workflow and the architectural bureaus in the GDR?
Yeah, so I mean, I haven't really looked at, for instance, things like specifications and how those sort of processes were in a way organized. What I was more interested in was sort of collaborative practices and where they're, you know, where they worked and didn't work, or where they were in a way kind of anticipated. So where architects were intended to work together with industrial designers or with landscape architects and so on, and yeah, sort of how these processes were organized. So I didn't really look so much at the organization of the office itself, but I think it would be, again, it would probably be very interesting to do that, you know, because these large construction firms, I mean, they were, of course, sort of enormous bureaucracies, right? I mean, there, the connection between construction on the one hand and, you know, kind of economic planning and economic output, and then the work, the sort of, yeah, the work that architects were doing in order to kind of make that output happen. But again, sort of how this sort of clerical, sort of minute work sort of then functioned, I don't know. I mean, I presume that in terms of workflow, there was probably quite a lot of standardization, actually. I mean, the only things that I came across, for instance, was when after an architectural competition, so you had typically a city planning office that was responsible for drawing up the master plan, and then the kind of lots were divided up and given to different district construction offices, who then basically went over those plans to then plan the typified housing onto each of those kind of Baugebiete. And so there you basically have these kind of specification sheets of those housing blocks, you know, and so on, and of the kind of social infrastructures, you know, kind of little buildings, nurseries, laundries and so on, you know, kind of little service buildings, all of which were kind of typified, you know, all of which were sort of part of this construction kit system. And yeah, even street furniture, all of that was in a way kind of pre-designed.
Let's open up for questions from the audience. So I'm happy, or we're happy to take your questions. And of course, German questions are welcome. Sie können gerne auf Deutsch Fragen stellen. Wir übersetzen, kommunizieren mit Ihnen. Who's got a question, or wer hat eine Frage?
Yeah, thank you very much for both talks. I would have a number of questions, but leave it up to very simple questions for the moment. Michael, you said the Bauhaus Centennial would give space for new, historic constructions on the meaning of the Bauhaus, or what could be the narrative which finally leads to the Bauhaus as we know it. And we all know these certain cliches and myths. We had very much talk on this kind of very classic historical myth. I got the impression that you are exactly doing this, a kind of narrative. It's not, it very much reminds me of the book Nicholas Pevsner did in the 30s, from William Morris to Walter Gropius, but of course your perspective is totally different. You are coming from the 19th century and trying to say that there are certain, let's say, models of architecture, a certain understanding of architecture, which is very important for the understanding of the Bauhaus. It's not the beginning of a story, but the end of a story, maybe. And along with this, there are certainly other categories coming up, like what is meant by the word type, what is meant by the word pattern. That would be another very important category for this kind of context. And the other thing is, I wondered how Edward Shaw, the historical material you presented and the sources, authors like Edward Shaw already are talking of the modern architect. And I mean, what is his understanding of the modern architect compared with the understanding of the Bauhaus and what they are understanding by this category. So. And the other point would be, of course, we have also this very interesting phenomenon already in the 18th century, when a lot of pattern books came up, especially in the context of the English Garden. And we also have this kind of standardization of urban planning with regulations, urban planning regulations, and so forth. So. What would you say? Is it would you say that your focus is mainly only on standardization, or is it only part of very specific understanding, rationalization, in general spoken, of planning culture?
Well, I can imagine that we Well, to the narrative question, because there were a bunch, and I would say that I don't see the Bauhaus as the end of anything. Okay. I think of the story I'm telling is also not quite the beginning either, but that the Bauhaus sits somewhere between two new historiographies. I would say that one takes on the kind of geopolitical revision, and I would say that the 19th century historiography is taking on a kind of labor politics revision. But what we haven't seen is a revision of that middle between those two, which is to say, I think if you took a closer look and a different look at the same archive, but instead of always assuming that what was being designed, as it were, was something around or through the standard, but always also a kind of a bureaucracy which was incipient in its kind of post-war bureaucracies of socialism. You can imagine already the afterlife if you can trace that back into an already bureaucratized Bauhausler, and also strangely a reworking of the labor politics in Germany in the teens and 20s. And I think if you work those historiographies towards that Bauhaus archive, I think you would come up with a very different historical narrative. So I think I think the trajectory is back towards that. So it feels like a middle and not an end or a beginning. And to the question about types and patterns and standards and specifications, my attempt generally has been to sort of take the idea of a type, which at least from postmodernism, at least since, let's say, Anthony Vidler or, I don't know, Amungers, had sort of identified it as an ideal around which we could all gather meaning in a kind of literary way. I would want to say that the type is something that has way, way a much harder way of defining meaning. It's much harder for us to get to meaning if we actually try and find an archive of the type. Which is to say, I think if Torsten tells us that they're planting garbage pails and park benches, the question of what's a type there is very, I don't know, because it's no longer one of these sort of perfect primitive huts, right? So I think if you want to just take those assumed historiographical anchors and unanchor them, I think that would be the project more generally as an intervention. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and even the word functionalism, yep, became an architectural category already in the late 18th century, when being transformed from administration, from the administration language into architectural language. Mm-hmm. So that's also quite interesting in this context, yeah, yeah. Because this is also the beginning of planning bureaucracy and the whole, yeah, let's say, complex of the expert and how we could differentiate between the builder and the architect and so forth. So, yeah.
Okay. Can I ask
you a
question?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was interested in sort of how do you deal with the point at which building products themselves become sort of industrial products, and therefore, you know, I mean, I guess what in Britain it's called the proprietary specification, or, you know, like the product-specific kind of spec. Does that play a role, or is that where your story kind of stops? Because that's also something that's still with us in a way with BIM and so on, no?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the proprietary specification it comes out from the materials testing world. and performance, and what, liability the industrial manufacturer would have to assume. So the specification is a kind of legal instrument in whatever way, and to your point, Karsten, it's to say that the architectural profession is a profession based largely on design is something I want to displace and say, well, design is underwritten by the law. And if you don't have legal standing, if you don't have liability, you don't have any purchase of intellectual labor, right? So you have to, the real point here would be that you only get creativity, you only get intellectual labor at the moment that you identify yourself with a legal apparatus that gives you that power. And so the more paperwork that surrounds a piece of wood or a metal or whatever it is, the more distance you have from that object and the more you identify yourself as a creative. But it's counterintuitive, because what we always say is, oh, creative people, they go and they just invent stuff. No, creative people, for the most part, just shuffle papers. And then every once in a while, there's some way of reshuffling them. And so we have to read, I think, you know, the strongest, I think, legacy of the Bauhaus is the pedagogy that it produced. And that's the thing that, what I'm calling an elite product that traveled through the sort of geopolitical kind of aftermath of World War II that we're still dealing with, at least in America, when, you know, in American, or let's just say students who come to the United States to study architecture, their assumption is that they're going to get some kind of fundamental knowledge coming from form. And there's that we have this to blame for, you know, like, so, and I just don't know of what value that is without also understanding that design expertise is underwritten by all those forms of proprietary knowledge, that they're complementary to.
Are there any other questions? Or maybe, Michael, do you have a question for Torsten?
Oh, yeah. Of course. I'm super curious about the third world, because I was wondering about what the chain of communication was there. If you could specify, as it were, it's obviously, I mean, you were saying that there's some affinity between the Finns, who are obviously not third worlders. But I'm curious about what other affinities you saw in third world countries and how they took up the sort of afterlife. I was curious about that, if you could speak to that.
Right. Well, I mean, I haven't really looked at that very much, sort of in terms of how, for instance, the Bauhaus in these other sort of third world or kind of global South contexts kind of lived on. I mean, apart from sort of visiting that great Bauhaus Imaginista show in Berlin, which I think is only sort of doing now a sort of little bit of the work of kind of uncovering those afterlives of the Bauhaus in the global South and the sort of various schools that were funded in India, and so on, and sort of some of these kind of migratory processes, like, you know, I mean, I mentioned Püschel and also Paulik, who, you know, didn't go to the Soviet Union, but actually ended up going to South Asia, to East Asia. Paulik to Shanghai, and Püschel ended up going to, that was after the war, to North Korea. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't quite answer that. But, you know, I mean, I guess what I can say is that there is this interest, at least in East Germany, among construction officials to engage, I mean, already in the 1960s, but it really becomes more prominent in the late 70s, early 80s. And I'm wondering to what extent this is to do with economic pressures, you know, with the fact that basically the country is very much kind of indebted to foreign debt and needs to bring in foreign currency and is sort of seeking out opportunity, not least sort of business opportunities by exporting construction labor, but increasingly then also, you know, this shifts from material labor to expertise. You know, I mean, there is an engagement also with tropical architecture in East Germany and with kind of knowledge around sort of building in the tropics and so on. And yeah, this also in a way then kind of influences, of course, you know, what's going on within East Germany itself and sort of raises questions as to, for instance, how well in environmental terms those buildings that have been constructed are performing and so on. So they're very interesting questions that are, you know, I mean, in a way they're kind of barely touched yet, but I feel that there is still a lot of work to do in that regard, in sort of following up these different entanglements.
Thanks. Again, the question, are there questions or comments? There's one.
Hey, okay. Thank you. I have a question regarding the standardization and the thing we're talking about, Michael, about architecture being something that is like a juggling of laws and see what you can do out of that. And I wonder if you put that in the context of the third world countries, as they used to be called. So let's say you take a country that was under a mandate and that inherited laws from another country, right? And then, so this country has to build exactly like the ruling administration and the laws that come from somewhere else. But funnily enough, the architecture that results is different. And I wonder, do you think it's because of culture? Is it because of contextual materials or because of economy? So it's more like comment question.
Well, I mean, yeah, and the mandate, it's an interesting reference anyway, because of course the Bauhauslers who ended up in the Middle East were enacting a Bauhaus that they thought was appropriate, as it were, to Tel Aviv, or and then those Bauhausers then move on to Africa. I thought you were referring also to this, as the recently some historians are looking at the ways in which Israeli architects actually exported expertise of the form of modernization that happened in the Middle East, which is what African countries that were decolonizing wanted to get recolonized by a decolonized country. So I think that there's the variation is in, let's say, I would say my speculative answer is that probably from one form of decolonization to a new form of decolonization, where the mandate, as it were, is, even if it was the same British colonizer in Palestine as it was the British colonizer in Nigeria, that the form of intellectual transmission was happening, well, from Germany through Israel to Africa. And I think then in each case you're going to get variation because of, generations of change and the process of decolonization itself. So rewriting the laws, new forms of apartheid, and you know, whatever it was in South Africa and so forth. But maybe towards the middle. No.
We're almost at the end of our panel discussion, but I guess I'd like to zoom out again a little bit and just want to ask you to what's next on your research agenda? So what comes next for you?
Okay, I've just talked to Michael about this earlier. Actually, it's something very different. It goes completely away from East Germany and Eastern Europe. I'm going to Canada in the summer, and I'm starting a project about queer activism and queer art in Toronto in the late 1960s, 1970s. So that's going to be the next project. It's something that developed out of teaching work around questions of gender and architecture.
Mine is actually a follow-up to this, so I've been talking about architecture as a data practice and looking at the ways in which specifications became computerized and the computerization of office work and the automation associated with clerical labor, which in a way makes it not so visible, not so apparent, not so physical. So I've been looking in archives of the computer firms that were actually adopting, that architecture practices were adopting computer technologies in the late 60s as ways of kind of automating the processes that we saw manually produced in the 19th century. That's what I've been working on.
Great. Well, thanks. And thank you very much for your fascinating talks and for the discussion. And I hope everyone joins us back here next week for Karin Köhler's lecture with the topic Walter Gropius Comes and Goes. And on that note, nice evening for everyone, and hope you join us back next week.